This is the feeling of generosity. And the joy that comes from generosity is kind of distinct qualities to it, because it is joyous, it's spacious, and it's not sticky. And that's how we know when we're really being generous, is those qualities, particularly that stickiness, you know. If there's some stickiness, then, oh, well, no, I want my little recognition reward, or I want something. But when it's really generous, it's not sticky. It doesn't mean that it's also that the greater surround is always so terrific. Sometimes it's not that way. Sometimes there's a kind of difficulty that arises along with that generosity, because the person that you're being generous to is a troubled person, and it's a mixed feeling. Or sometimes you choose to be generous to someone who feels very entitled, and that doesn't feel so good either. So where we get in trouble is when we don't really recognize that it's truly a practice. And our letting go and our not having extra agendas in terms of our generosity becomes very important. There was I just had a conversation, I guess Tuesday of this week, with a person that I had met on retreat, and was very encouraging of this person going to Thailand to study. And so the person sort of interrupted their life to study Dhamma, to have this experience for a year of really getting immersed in Dhamma. And so they went over to Thailand, and they were thinking they were going to study Vipassana with this monk. And there was this whole thing that they weren't sure that there was going to be room for them in the first place. And that's a wonderful experience, having done this myself, where you go over and you don't know if there's even a place to stay, or all of this is all this uncertainty. Because that degree of letting loose of our control, and this person was very aware of that. He was reporting about because he likes to really control things, and this was, he didn't know about all this. But in fact, there was room in the monastery for him, and they took him in. And so then he was roaring to get started on his samadhi practice and his vipassana practice and all this. And the head monk said, well, you know, actually here, the first thing we do is we study generosity. And so there was this time period around generosity. And then the monk said, well, you know, the second thing we study here is sila, the ethics. And after that, we start teaching you vipassana. And that is the traditional way. The dana and the sila, and then the bhavana, it's called, this development practice, how we develop our mind hearts. But the kind of joy and the kind of letting loose that comes from the generosity, the lack of putting ourselves at the center in the same way, is the traditional way of beginning this practice. And there's the practical reason for that in terms of practical reason is that when the mind is not distorted by our greed or envy or our jealousy, and not distorted by having to separate ourselves from actions that we know others would disapprove of, that we would feel shame or guilt or feel rejected, that we'd let people down if we do. If either of those conditions are present, it makes practice much more difficult in a very practical way, because the mind's cluttered, the mind's tight, the mind's defending itself. There's parts we have to stay away from because we'll feel guilty or feel ashamed, or we can't let anyone know. So this is the importance of starting in this way. More in the Western tradition that Jack and Joseph and Sharon and others brought back when they were first over there, we bring all these into play at once. We bring the vipassana, the samadhi, and the metta, and all of the practices in at one time, so there will be this kind of integration of these various practices. But nonetheless, to remember that this is the way it's done, and for each of us to reflect for ourselves. I had a whole different thing I was going to do tonight, but I've decided to switch, and we're going down this direction, because once I realized that, oh, this is a perfect opportunity, then let's just take advantage of it. And so that's what our exploration is tonight. And I'm going to, so this is all extemporaneous. And I want you to reflect for a moment on when you perceive that someone, just top of your head, when has someone been generous to you? Think of a time. We're going to just do this in silence here. Now, holding that memory in mind, did you think of a time of large generosity or someone being generous in a small way? How many large? Thank you. And how many small? Thank you. They both count. They both count. So we're not trying to, we in our minds, we can have a take for granted small moments of generosity. Why? Does that make us feel better to kind of not count them, to discount them, to not notice them? I didn't make any distinction here, so if you thought of a large one, that would have given the emotion in the room perfectly understandable, so there's no judging of ourselves about this. I wanted to create this opportunity, and if you've thought of a large one, this is helpful to the point I was wanting to make. So you were serving the Sangha in that moment. But we so often don't count the small acts of generosity. And yet, the world would be horrible without these small acts of generosity. You know, someone letting us in, someone holding the door, particularly if we got our hands full, someone, the way they get, you know, we're trying to get an appointment with a doctor, and someone goes to extra trouble to find a place, or they say, I'll call you back when something opens, and they actually call you back. Or someone takes extra time for you and something they're doing for you. Or someone really does a good job of something they're doing. It could be something small, but they do a really good job. We are all the beneficiaries of that generosity in this way. When you think, going back to your moment there of remembering your generosity, did you feel obligation around thinking about that generosity? If you've received generosity, there is not in any given act, it's not an exchange. It's not something that's owed coming back the other way. You may choose to be generous back to that person, but not because it's owed, but because you see the benefit of generosity and you wish to participate in the generous circuit. So this often comes up in relation to teaching the Dhamma, because the people I know that teach Dhamma do not want you to feel obligated in any sort of that you owe them. They want you to celebrate what you have gained and celebrate its role in your life. And of course celebrate your passing it forward. But this is one of the beauties of the Dana system, just giving for the teachings rather than paying for the teachings, is that it's not a marketplace experience. That in a lot of the daily classes and all around the Bay area, and it's going to happen more and more around the country, there's going to be charging for classes just because the teachers to take the time to do it are just, they're going to, they, we run into this a lot with our young teachers. The Donna system isn't working for the small things like classes or even for day-longs in many instances. It's just not working. There's not enough money for people who like you, are trying to, you know, pay your rent and pay health insurance and all of that, so that it's getting, at this time in our society at least, in our culture, the Donna system may be more and more limited to retreats. If that's what's necessary for now, that's okay. But I just so value the Donna system and hope that it can flourish. And if it has to be limited to retreats now, that's fine. But then eventually come back into the daily experiences. But we have to support our young teachers. We just have to, when I say young, I don't mean just young of age. I mean teachers that are beginning, that are wanting to do this on a more full-time basis. And if we're going to have a diverse group of teachers, we have to support those teachers, because to some degree, most of the teachers you've been exposed to in the last 20, 30 years have had second jobs. They teach Dharma and they do something else. And that's how they make it work. So they're not counting in the same way. But as this is all turned around now, it's and we hear this at Spirit Rock from our young teachers saying, I can't afford to do this. We're trying right now to get people to teach on the month-long retreat. And that's really disruptive to earning a living. Mm-hmm. And what do we do to make this work out okay for a teacher to do a 30-day retreat that does not, a teacher not having some other kind of an income that supports them, or having a local sangha that's really generous to them, which is the other thing we have in a few instances. We have some number of teachers now living fully on Donna. And usually that happens because there's a sangha that is supporting them in that way. So this is just various reflections about generosity. Now, think of a time where you have been generous to someone. Anybody having trouble claiming one? Isn't that amazing? You know, that's really delusion. So look at how we can be holding ourselves, that we don't, we have some thing about ourselves where when we apply it to ourselves, it has to be 100% pure maybe, because there was something you wanted, so you can't do that. Or there's some a priori belief that, oh, I'm not a generous person. I didn't ask you if you were a generous person. I ask you to think about a time when you were generous to someone. I could interview each of you, and we would find time after time when, in fact, in ways small and large, that you have been generous. Could there have been more times for each of us to have been generous? Certainly true for me. It's certainly true for me. I did not know that I'd been among the first to support the program, but I'm very happy that there was that much spontaneity. There used to be a program for these volunteers that took care of the trails, and I love that these people were out taking care of our walking trails in Mount Tamanaw. So I always sent in, you know, a donation, and then one day I got this letter back, and they said, you know, you're on our list, so you always get a solicitation, but you don't have to give every time you get a solicitation. I thought that was so generous. I thought that was so generous in this way. And that warmed me, that they were noticing that. They were noticing me as a person. That warmed me the way I would hope it would warm those volunteers, my giving, you see? So that there's The generosity is not just something to do with money. Lots of times we need, we're someone who needs money. We need the generosity of others to help us in that way. But a lot of times it's attention that's needed, that someone to listen to us. And please hear this. I said listen. I did not say fix. In our society, it's becoming steadily more rare that someone will listen to you without trying to fix you. There has developed in our society the idea that if someone's listening, they're supposed to make suggestions. They're supposed to somehow do something to make it okay. This is not very Buddhist. Because from a Buddhist point of view, it is being with the experience that the experience gets resolved. But when we're talking about a difficulty with a friend or in a relationship or sort of feeling discouraged about our lives, our friends often don't really have anything they can offer at this moment. But you've already thought of those things. And also the other three people you mentioned it to gave you all their suggestions already. And they're the same suggestions. So the importance of being generous in listening to one another. It feels wonderful to be listened to. It feels really wonderful. Likewise, being generous in our mudita, our happiness for the happiness of others. Being generous when someone says, I just ran a 7K. I just got this. This happened to me. I'm over this illness. My child got a scholarship to whatever the good news is. To truly be available for another person's good news is generous. Is it cost-free to us? Not initially, oftentimes, because maybe their generosity is something that we would have liked for ourselves or our child or our friend or whomever it may be. It's not always initially cost-free. But once you find mudita, once you find this generosity of spirit for someone else's happiness, it actually is a reward for us because the happiness becomes our happiness in a no BS way. I'm not being syrupy sentimental here. I am meaning that quite literally. That the happiness for someone else becomes our happiness. This is a phenomena of the maturity of practice, that we have this kind of feeling of mudita, this happiness for those. It's called sympathetic joy. It's not empathetic, it's sympathetic. We're not identifying with them in an empathetic way. It is their happiness over there. Our happiness is because we're getting to witness happiness. You get that distinction? So I'm going to give time for questions and comments by the end of all of this. I don't know where this is going to end or so forth yet, but this is the way it is. Likewise, with generosity, when we hold someone with a forgiving attitude, a forgiving is not the right word, it's an assuming the best of their intentions, that they have a benign intention, that we start out not in naive trusting, but in a realistic kind of trusting of the intention of another. Even if there's mixed motives, and we can feel those mixed motives, we can distance ourselves from someone by saying they're wanting this from me, da 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 da, or we can say that in their kind words to me, they sincerely mean this, and they have other motives that are coming into play. Are any of us exempt from mixed motives? I've mentioned in here other times in the Majjhima Nikaya, I think it's MN57, there's a whole teaching where the Buddha talks about their completely pure motives that lead to completely pure results. There's impure motives or intentions that lead to impure results. And then there's mixed motives which lead to mixed results. It's just the way it is. We will have mixed motives, sometimes appropriately, sometimes not appropriately. As we are able to stay present with the truth of our motivation and see them and see what leads to happiness for us and others and what leads for unhappiness, suffering to ourselves and others, the motives on their own, through this vipassana, through the sati, the mindfulness practice, our motives gradually become more pure. They become less caught in the fetters, less caught in the hindrances. We don't have to do it. The interest will help us. And there are times when we can choose to participate in an active way where we go, every time I'm with this person, I'm wanting something from this person. I'm going to stop that. At least this time, I'm going to interact with this person without thought of wanting. And we see how we do. And we gradually learn to get better. I remember when I first was practicing with Joseph Goldstein, and I got, just because of circumstances, there were times when I got to be alone with him. We'd be taking a walk or something. And my first thought was, wow, this is an opportunity. You know, I really need to take advantage of this. And then that felt weird. But it also was a very practical kind of thought, right? So I kind of go, why is this not feeling better? And then I realized I had such appreciation for my teacher that I did not want to be spending his time with me wanting something. That was, even though it was in fact an opportunity, that was the wrong balance. And so I let loose of that. And it didn't mean that things didn't come up where I continued to get to learn. If I had some question, I could own it in a direct way. But I was not spending my time with Joseph and seeking self-improvement in that way when it was personal time. If I was going in for a practice discussion and a retreat, that was different. I wasn't there to hang out with Joseph. I was there, you know, to report my experience and let him give me direction. But that did not have to spill over to the entire relationship. Do you see what I mean? In this way. So over time, I got more and more able to do that just because I consciously practiced it. So by the time I got to Ajahn Sumedho, I did not have that kind of relationship with Ajahn Sumedho. When I got any opportunity to just be with him, I was just being with him. And wholesome things came from that. When I stand here at the end of class, I'm making myself available as a teacher. We're not hanging out. You know, I'm here to serve you in that way. But if I run into you in the supermarket and we're chatting in the supermarket, from my view, we're hanging out in the supermarket. And it's what your view is your view for your reasons. But I bring this up because it's whether you, whomever you're running into, you know, any of the teachers you have, in any form, including your therapist, or your body worker, or anybody else that's your gardener. When you run into your gardener at the supermarket, they're not wanting to talk about your roses while they're buying their food. And yet it's so easy for us to do this. And whatever role you've played, you've seen this in the other way. You've been the gardener, or the therapist, or the teacher, or whatever it may be. You've been in that role and seen it the other way. So this generosity of spirit is how we're meeting people moment to moment in our lives. This bell, which I brought because I didn't want to lug my big bell tonight that I will often bring, This bell has a really wonderful sound, I think, at least, my view. I don't really have the right to hold it this way. It's not the best way to hear the sound. Hear that low sound? I think it's a D. Those of you who would, musicians, you know better than I. So how this bell ended up here, and those of you who have been at the Sangha for a long time have heard the story before. I was teaching in New Mexico somewhere, and nobody brought a bell for me to use. They just had those little chime things, which don't work for me. Something feels too precious about it for my own conditioning. That's not a universal truth. So I asked, does anybody that's here have a bell? And somebody had driven down from Arizona. He raised his hand and says, I've got a bell. And so he brought it and he used his bell at every sit. And towards the, I think it was a week-long retreat, it could have been 10 days, but towards the end of the retreat, he said, you know, Philip, I'd like to give you this bell. And I said, well, it's your bell, and you did something better. I tried to, slough it off. And he says, no, I really want to do this. I said, okay. And I did not, I had a great deal of discomfort, not feeling of, oh, he's wanting to give me the bell. I appreciated that thought, but I very much experienced it from my point of view. Like, I don't want to take his bell. And then, to make matters much worse, one time during the lunch period, I happened to go into the hall, and there he was sitting up front, listening to his bell because he wasn't going to be hearing it. Well, that cooked it for me, right? That was the end. So I was not going to take this bell. So at the end of the retreat, he reminded me that I was taking the bell, and I had to leave because of some scheduling thing. I was going to teach another retreat, so I had to leave in the morning before we broke at 11 o'clock or something, this retreat. So I sneaked out. and I was really like very satisfied with that experience. And then I get this letter. Why did you not take your bell? Talk about feeling busted. He said, I wanted you to have this bell. Why did you not receive my generosity? Ouch. Ouch. He was my teacher. I was unwilling to receive his generosity because I made an evaluation that the bell was more precious for him to have than for me to have. I was making a life decision for him. Now, what was that basis? What gave me the right to do that? There was no right. There was no excuse for this at all. And it triggered a whole series of seeing how, due to various things in my own childhood, I had always had a resistance to a kind of generosity. I only wanted generosity from people, in whatever form it was coming, that I thought they could afford to give it, and that somebody else shouldn't get it in terms of me. If someone else should have this generosity rather than me, then I didn't want it. I wanted it to go to that other person. It sounds wholesome enough on the surface, right? That was me. And on the surface, in my mind, I was really honoring generosity, and I was being mature in it. But looked at more closely, what I was doing was controlling the circumstances around my own relationship with receiving generosity. Now, I don't tell this story to enjoy telling a story on me, although I don't mind telling stories on me, but to ask you, how many times have you controlled the conditions of receiving generosity? How many times have you actually repositioned it so that it wasn't generosity? Right? Well, I mean, after all, she's my mother, or whatever it is. But really? There are times, even with a difficult mother, there's times if really it was generous. What was owed you? You know, what was owed you as a child in that way? Or with a friend? Or somebody at work, or a school teacher, or someone on the street, or in the supermarket, or again in a doctor's office, or so many different places. Even an airline ticket counter, where people have in fact been generous. And how many times have we not wanted to receive generosity because we wanted someone else, or that we thought if they really knew something about us, they wouldn't want to give it to us, or I've wanted generosity to be given to someone that needed it more. So I wrote one time about when I worked all through my childhood, and I worked in a supermarket for a number of years, and in those days, you know, you bagged groceries and you often carried them out to people's cars and all. And it was the people with little money that would give a tip. I lived in a very hierarchical town, and I was in the low end of the hierarchy of this town, and it was very hierarchical. And so the people came to this supermarket, which was a mixed thing. We only got supermarkets during the time I was growing up. And it was a mixed clientele, and the people who would want at Christmas time in particular would want to give tips would be the people that had the more rundown cars and the more, you know, things like this, or maybe a whole bunch of kids in the car, and I would not want to receive a tip. I wanted one of those kids to get the money. I didn't want a dime. I didn't want anything from people I thought that didn't have enough to be giving. What a point of view. What a point of view I was holding to. I was going to determine when it was right for someone else to be generous. It was too self-referenced. Do you see that? And I learned to accept, and the times that I was most affected in terms of that, and in terms of building generosity in me, was that person that gave when I really didn't think they had it to give. That was when I was most affected. If there's been generosity blossom in me, each of those people were watering that seed in me. So generosity is, what to call it? A many-rooted, fed by many streams, many waterings. It flowers in all these different ways, just like that. Like there's all these different kinds of flowers, so there's all these different kinds of generosity, and so it is to feel the nourishing of generosity in us, to see the generosity in another, even if we're not the recipient of that generosity, but someone else is the recipient. We can celebrate that generosity in another. Sometimes, again, and I'm really trying to cover the waterfront here in terms of all the shadowy side of this, sometimes someone else can be receiving generosity and we're not receiving it. And it feels weird. And that, in fact, may not be right. You may see others get generous praise for the work they do in the Sangha, and the work you do in the Sangha doesn't get generous praise. That's not, quote, right. In terms of the balance, if that's happening in our Sangha, then that's to that degree we're out of balance in terms of our generosity with praise. But that doesn't diminish, and we shouldn't begrudge the praise that's coming to another, because we want people to be generously praised for their generosity, for their service. Do you see? And then it becomes a letting go. A letting go. And what we learn about letting go, this non-attachment, this cause of suffering, our grasping, our thirst, our attachment, we see that in letting go of our attachment, even our attachment as to what should be, what's right, is we let go of our attachment to that insofar as it's affecting us. We're reducing the amount of suffering, not just for ourselves, but the amount of suffering in the world. There's so much value in understanding all the different ways that generosity shows up, and this letting go is part of it. We cannot be generous to others because they've not been generous to us. But is that who we want to be? I don't think so. There is appropriateness. It is that if someone can't meet us, then we have to change how we, and the social contract, interact with them. Otherwise, you're being taken advantage of. Otherwise, you're adding to their bad karma of letting them exploit you. We don't want to let others exploit us. That's not the discussion here. And if there's something off in any in your family unit, in the Sangha, in the community, we want to bring that into balance. But we don't want to do it from our miserliness, from our holding on. At least I don't. I'm clear on that. That I want to meet this moment from as much generosity as possible in this moment. I want the generosity to be appropriate. I say, when I do Dana talks, don't give in a way that hurts you. That's not being generous. That's being a martyr. We don't need martyrs. Martyrdom leads to some dark places. So we don't need martyrs. But we want to hold this generosity feeling, both receiving and giving, in a balanced way. We want to see it in terms of attachment and non-attachment. We want to see it in the joy. We want to see it in terms of sila. We want to see it in terms of our bhavana, in terms of the vipassana. We want to see it in terms of being able to stay grounded. We want to see it in terms of love. We want to see it in terms of compassion, sort of the metta, the karuna. We want to see it as sympathetic joy. We want to know generosity in relation to maintaining our own equanimity and to hold it in all this way and to be so careful that we don't start assuming. So this person's got a lot of money. Why aren't they doing more? Or this person never praises, or this person never gives their time. You know, where we're falling into judging others, or comparing ourselves to others, or fixing others. We don't want to fall into those traps either, as you've heard me talk about so many times in here. So this is the reflections on generosity. I'm going to hold that. I'll just read this poem, which I just picked up off my desk for whatever reason. And it's called Blessing the Boats. Have any of you heard this poem, Blessing the Boats? May the tide that is entering even now, may the tide that is entering even now, the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind, then turn from it, certain that it will love your back. May you open your eyes to water wavering forever, and may you, in your innocence, sail through this to that. Whatever this is, may you sail through this to that. That is a generous attitude. That is a generous loving kindness. That you have this faith to turn your back, and that the wind will have your back, that this caring, the generosity of others will have your back. It's beautiful. Beyond the face of fear. Beyond the face of fear. Not that the fear isn't there, but that we are not stuck in that fear. Beyond the face of fear. Any question or comment about generosity? I've taken most of our time here.
Who wrote the poem?
Lucille Clifton, C-L-I-F-T-O-N. for Sue Clifton. Any question or comment?
When you said that, it's very funny. So I work for a Japanese agency, and the culture is that for social services, we work on a donor basis. It's all donations. And so my services, when I go out, are free. And I have family that's very, very, very affluent. And I spent very, very much of my time with them. And they have, over the last 5 years I've worked with them, not made one donation. Now, I give them good service, but I'll go into my executive directory and I'll say, they just don't, and they have lots of money. And they just gave a very, very, very generous donation to the agency. I give them the same service, but as you're talking, I'm so aware of my attitude toward them. And I work with people who have very, very little money, and they give a little bit, and I just am so aware of that generous. But what I'm most aware of in this situation, is, as you were talking, is my attitude, giving them the same service, they don't know the difference.
Right.
How judgmental.
Yeah, so how we hold, and of course, who's the loser there is us in this way.
Of course.
Yeah. I used to have this one. Those of you who know me, you won't be surprised at this. I was the number one bagger in the supermarket. People would literally wait for me till they'd stand at the counter because they wanted me to bag their groceries, because the bags never ripped, of course. this one woman would come, and she would buy her groceries, and then she would have me take her home, and we would walk for like 15 minutes or something, with me pushing this buggy and then taking her groceries inside for her and all of this and then back. And she never gave any kind of a tip or anything. And I remember that for my first period of time, how I was judgmental of her. And then it dawned on me, that why am I being like this? I don't know her story. It was a very nice home she lived in and all this, but I didn't know her story. Why was I putting something on other than that bare attention at the start of the meditation? I was getting to help her, something she wanted help with. So why wasn't I just relishing my experience? What was I doing spending time in my head judging someone else, even period, but let around something I didn't know about? And I gradually, the Dharma of work, which is, we learn so much in work, that hit me as a kid to stop doing that. And so this was all part of my growing, the meager amount of understanding of generosity I have. And so, yes, that's a wonderful teaching for you. And with that, we will stop and we will close our eyes. As I closed my eyes, I was reflecting on the generosity of your attention. And just feeling the generosity of that. So thank each of you for your generosity of attention. And then have us let loose of words and let loose of even concepts or principles of understanding, and drop into the felt experience right now of our own hearts. What is this experience of the heart? And then the same with the intuitive body, with that area right below the belly button is the way to access our intuition. What is our intuition's experience of this moment? Just being available for knowing or resolve or freedom to arise in the heart. And now the belly. Inspiration, or calm, or energy. Sense of presence. This is just being. And now checking in with the head center, where we have all of our views and opinions, our attitudes. Is the head center quiet or busy? Leaving it alone, just noticing. Quiet or busy? If it's busy, what's it doing? Is it judging or comparing or fixing? Is it planning? Is it remembering? Is it rehearsing a conversation? What's that head center doing? So independent. Being generous to our heart, to our intuition, and generous towards our head center.